burning in the flames of a homemade crematorium, the remains of yet another man, murdered at the hands of a serial killer.
He wasn't just a statistic. He was somebody's son. He was mine.
Sheila LaBar liked to be in control. She used her body to get what she wanted. Men, mere morsels to catch, using rather obvious seductions.
People around town gave her a nickname. They called her Sheila the Peeler. They were always hoping that she would flash a little this or show a little bit of that.
As investigators tried to uncover the layers of Sheila LaBar, they were trying to get inside the mind of a serial killer.
She was able to suck those men in, almost like a spider in a spider web, bringing them into their cave where she eventually would kill them.
Sheila LaBar's seductions were not about sex. They were about taking lives before hiding the evidence.
This is a story that begins with the discovery of bones in a burning pile on a remote farm.
They were human bones, and they were male. An investigation into who and why they were being disposed of in such a do-it-yourself way followed their discovery. The picture exposed revealed a rare species in the grisly portrait gallery of serial killers, a woman called Sheila LaBar, who ran a farm one day sold at auction, attending a mother who had warned many times that it was here her son was tortured.
His face was all cut up. His hands were all cut up. One of them was immobile. His head was down. He was ashen in color. He was all cut up, and he was in a wheelchair, and he couldn't walk.
Drawing on first-person testimonies from those whose lives intersected with Sheila LaBar, Linda Papadopoulos has been on a journey of exploration inside the mind of a serial killer. A journey which begins with understanding how Sheila would choose a victim. It would always be a man, and he would be vulnerable.
I think Kenneth County was particularly vulnerable because he actually had learning difficulties. And what we know is that Sheila invites him to come and live with her, but effectively ends up keeping him like a slave.
I said, "Did she hurt my son? Did she hurt my son? Please tell me, did she hurt my son?"
What brushstrokes are needed to make up the complete picture of Sheila LaBar? Not good ones. Then known as Sheila K. Bailey, she grew up in a tiny mill community in Alabama. The first not-so-subtle clues as to her behavior later in life come from those early days.
Sheila's childhood was very troubled. Her older sister says that Sheila was the subject of sexual abuse from her father and from other men.
Kevin Flynn knows Sheila well. He spent hundreds of hours with her researching her life story. Sheila's timeline is populated by horror stories filled with monsters.
One evening, Sheila's father comes home drunk, and he's rummaging around in the refrigerator and throwing everything on the floor, and he's in a very foul mood. And he turns his attention to his wife and his two youngest daughters. They decide that they're going to flee the house. They're running towards the cornfields near the back of their property. Their angry father picks up a can of paint and throws it at them, and it hits Sheila in the head, causing a lot of bleeding.
Her suffering escalated. Sheila was a victim of monstrous abuse.
She was passed around as a toy. She was a sex object for her father, for his friends. She was abused mentally, she was abused physically, and most of all, abused sexually.
By the time she had reached 18, Sheila appeared happy enough. but she left as an escape route from the abusive home and from small-town America.
Sheila has big dreams. She wants to move out of this little town. She wants to become either a model or a country music singer. And so she's looking for a way to get out of her life. And one of the ways that many girls do that in a small town is to marry a guy. And so she got her hooks into a guy by the name of John Baxter. John was a lineman for a utility, had a good job, but he was divorced.
John Baxter had a 4-year-old daughter called Wendy. She was about to discover what it meant to have an abused, mixed-up stepmother for a carer.
Sheila was not the most maternal person. Wendy told her father that when he would go to work, Sheila would put Wendy in the closet. And it was also then that Sheila would take care of her by making her drink something. Brandy, maybe it's cough syrup, something that made her feel very sleepy. And this was her way of taking care of the daughter throughout the day. Essentially, she didn't want to deal with her.
Maybe it's a case of the abused becoming the abuser.
That kind of treatment did not sit well with John. When he found out that that's what Sheila was doing, he basically said, "You're out of here." So that was a pretty quick relationship. I believe they got married on New Year's Eve, and by Valentine's Day, they were divorced.
As she became older, became bitter, vengeful, brooding, Sheila sexualized herself to lure men into her spider's web.
And I feel that part of this would have led her to see men as perhaps just valuing her for the way that she looked. And so perhaps what we're seeing here is her trying to take back control of that objectification and use it for her benefit.
And whilst it was to her benefit to have a man close by, that's what she arranged. A series of them came and went. What was it like to be her partner? A man called Ronnie Jennings was to discover how violent she could be. At first, he had fallen for her physical charms.
She basically wants to be loved. She wants to have a normal life. She thinks that Ronnie can provide that. But they're not really clicking. They're not really getting along. She takes out her frustrations on Ronnie. She's abusive to him.
No longer was she going to be the victim. She wanted to make sure that the people she was involved in a relationship, that she had utter, complete, 100% control, much like her father had complete control over her.
It was early days in the development of what Sheila would become. She controlled by being physically abusive. Ronnie would later give evidence that he was concerned she'd attack him whilst he slept. The threat of violence was never very far away.
He decides that he doesn't want to be in the relationship anymore. This crushes Sheila.
And she responds in dramatic fashion.
We know that she has a suicide attempt.
Sheila takes a handful of pills in front of Ronnie and gets in the car and drives away, gets into an accident. Sheila is nearly killed from the crash and the overdose. What was interesting about this incident is that while Sheila was in the hospital, she had gone into a coma and recovered. But when she came back, she told everybody that she had died, gone to heaven, and God had sent her back as an avenging angel. And this was the persona that she carried with her throughout the rest of her life.
By 1986, the psychological makeup of Sheila K. Bailey was in place. An abused child who had become an abuser. A controlling woman who could be violent to men.
So when you take her childhood experiences and now that she's an adult, is she now a hater of men?
In her late 20s, the avenging angel comes across an advert placed by a man 1,300 miles away in Epping, New Hampshire. A successful chiropractor, he also had 1,200 acres of upscale prime land.
He was a widower. He lived on a horse farm in rural New Hampshire. He was very lonely after losing his wife and wanted companionship.
Wilfred LeBar, known in his local community as a kindly man, lost his wife in 1985. On coming across the advert in 1987, Sheila sees a chance for a new life. The aspiring model doesn't want to miss out on this opportunity. She plans a way to get the job of companion to old man.
And she knew how to answer that ad. She just didn't write and say what she was looking for in a man, long romantic walks on a beach. She got right down to the point. She bared her breasts. She exposed herself, sent photos of herself in very sensual positions, and she got a response.
She just doesn't send a message saying, hey, I'm interested. She sends it with topless photos. She's very quickly cottoned on to the fact that if she wants to get Labar's attention, she needs to sexualize this interaction as much as possible.
Well, he fell pretty hard for her. Sheila immediately got on a plane and began dating Wilfred Labar. And she insinuated herself into his life almost immediately.
Soon, Sheila takes the name of the much older man. There is no marriage, but Sheila K. Bailey is a thing of the past. The world and Wilfred Labar are introduced to Sheila Labar, and she won't be playing the role of the compliant wife anytime soon.
Sheila was now engaged in a relationship with somebody that could very well at least be the age of her father. And she's this beautiful woman at the time, and she's able to manipulate and control because the older man is looking at Sheila, this is one of life's bonuses. How could somebody like himself get this beautiful young woman? And so she used that Sheila's web. She was able to suck him in and eventually use that to her advantage.
She started to take over his chiropractic business. She became the office manager and basically ran off all of the other employees that were, you know, who could see through her. She separated Dr. Labar from his grown kids. Basically, she worked to isolate Dr. Labar and to take over his life and his property.
To get that level of control, she had used her sexuality. Soon, she would use abuse.
Sheila was violent with Dr. Labar. There were times where, to get away from her, to let her cool off, Dr. Labar would leave his own house, and he would walk almost a mile to the next neighbor's house and crash on their couch because, you know, he just didn't want to be around Sheila that night.
How extreme would the avenging angel take her violence? How wicked were her intentions? Between 1986 and 2003, Sheila Labar insinuated herself into the life of a man who had been a successful businessman and capable father. The relationship lasts, but at a price to Wilfred Labar.
This is a woman who's in total command. For 17 years, she rules Wilfred Labar's life.
This was all part of a larger scheme of Sheila's, which was to separate Dr. Labar from his children, and to take control over his life financially, emotionally, physically.
Sheila had it all. Run of the farm, control over the business, and soon, who was going to get what from his estate?
She convinces him to give her power of attorney, to sign over property, and he does, because he doesn't want to lose her. He perhaps maybe doesn't feel worthy to have somebody at the time as beautiful as Sheila, but she's able to use what she believes is her beauty and charm to convince him to basically sign over everything.
How was she controlling Wilfred? Flaunting her sexuality, using it to manipulate. Indeed, she had quite a reputation in Epping.
People around town gave her a nickname. They called her Sheila the Peeler.
She would often be in very scantily dressed clothes and sometimes just drop it and bare it all.
Well, she had no problem coming to the door for delivery men wearing almost nothing. It got to the point where it was sort of anticipated and, you know, it was expected that she would be very provocative and, you know, try to stir things up. She definitely used her womanly ways to get what she wanted. Sheila is always thinking about how she can manipulate men to get what she wants.
I think we live in a world that objectifies women, that sexualizes women. And I think in her case, clearly this was something that she saw as a tool that she wanted to use for her benefit rather than having it used against her.
Whilst living with Wilfred, Sheila, bizarrely because he doesn't object, decides to marry. But not Wilfred. She comes across a drifter down on his luck, a vulnerable man.
His name was Wayne Ennis. He was a migrant farm worker, and Sheila just fell for him. And what was so strange is that Sheila brings Wayne Ennis to the horse farm, and the three of them now, Dr. Labar, Sheila, and her new husband Wayne, are all living together on this farm.
According to Wayne Ennis, when later tracked down by police, 18 months after marrying Sheila, she proposed something radical to make their lives a little more comfortable.
She's intimating to Wayne Ennis that he needs to do something to hasten Dr. Labar's death. Wayne is very troubled by this, so he goes to Dr. Labar and tells him what Sheila is planning. And he's fearful as well for his own safety. Dr. Labar then drove Wayne to a bus station, got him on a bus, and he got out of town, and Sheila never saw him again.
In the year 2000, Wilfred Labar died.
Sheila told Dr. Labar's family that just one day he'd had a heart attack and died on the kitchen floor. And she insisted that he be cremated. It wasn't until later that people thought that this was suspicious. At the time, nobody thought much about Dr. Labar's death, that it was anything other than natural causes.
Sheila K. Bailey, the abused, penniless, aspirant model of old Alabama, is ancient history. As the new millennium begins, Sheila Labar is a propertied woman whose appetite for men is still alive and well, especially if they're easy to abuse.
She went from being the victim to being the predator, to identifying those who are vulnerable, whether by age, or by mental capacity, or because of their own relationships with their own family, and she chose her victims wisely as far as being vulnerable.
She lures one after another, always being violent towards them, eventually meeting this man, Michael Deloge.
Michael Deloge is sort of a lost soul. He sees himself as a songwriter, as a poet. He had been married and had a kid, but that relationship fell apart. He got into drugs and alcohol, and he found himself many miles from home in a homeless shelter in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. He was separated from his family, and it was Sheila who came along and found him. The prospect of staying in a homeless shelter or going with this woman to a farm where he could get a nice warm bed and a steady job and sex, well, that's a very easy decision to make.
It was around now that Sheila began a go-to tactic, taping conversations.
Sheila has an interesting habit of recording her telephone calls and her conversations.
The recordings would be used by her to control whichever men she lured to the farm. She would force them to make false confessions, to agree that they'd been abused as a child. Mike was the first to suffer what would be described later as brainwashing.
Sheila convinces Mike that growing up, he was sexually abused and that he is a pedophile. Now the family says, no way, this isn't... The people that he is saying that he abused were never abused. Where is he getting this idea? Sheila is telling him this. Sheila is preventing him from calling his family.
Almost a brainwashing technique. You isolate someone and you can have vast influence over that person. So she would isolate the people she had relationships with, keep them away from others in society.
She's also poisoning the relationship and getting into his head until he believes it. He actually believes that he is a child molester because she has told him that so many times.
So therefore, she would have that ultimate control, much like a puppet master.
the puppet master had Michael Deloge dancing to her tune. There were regular sightings of him over the 2 years that he was known to be on the farm, but one day he was seen in troubling circumstances.
The neighbors describe an incident where, coming down the wood path from the horse farm, they saw a man stumbling and bleeding from the head. It was Michael Deloge, and he just walked right past a neighbor and said one word, Sheila.
Michael Deloge would never be seen alive again. In 2006, Sheila LaBar was living on the farm alone. The men she had preyed on had displayed one kind of vulnerability or other. They were much older, homeless, drifters down on their luck. Next in line was Kenneth County, a young man with development difficulties.
When it came time for sports, Kenny aced it. But he had problems with his friends because he didn't speak properly. So they would tease him and taunt him. And that's how it was.
At 24 years old, Kenny had the mental capacity of a 12-year-old. In February of that year, depressed at failing to be admitted into the army after training camp, he tried to kill himself.
At that time, Kenny took some pills, and they took him to the hospital. They called me. I went to the hospital, and they had guards, police guards, watching over Kenny. And I just shook my head, and I said, why?
Kenny recovered. Though she was unaware at the time, it is after the suicide attempt that his mother Carolyn believes Kenny came across Sheila LaBar.
I was told at the time they met on a chat line. Come to find out, when I found out in court, it was a sex chat line. And Kenny wanted to be like anybody else. He wanted to be loved. He wanted to be accepted. And Sheila searched for those that had problems, and she could tell that Kenny had problems in his speaking, in his thinking, and that's how she went after him, on a sex chat line.
She was using telephone dating services where you would leave a message in somebody's voicemail box, and Sheila had a habit of screening the calls, and if the man sounded confident, if he sounded like he really had it all together, she would delete those messages. If the guy sounded meek, if he sounded like he might not be of high intelligence, if he sounded like he was somebody that she could manipulate, she kept those messages and contacted those guys.
One of those she followed up with was Kenny County.
Kenny met her on February 14th. They met at a bar, Valentine's Day, in New Hampshire. It was a big age gap. He was only 24. She was in her 40s, 47.
They have a few drinks, and they move from the bar to the back seat of Sheila's car, where they have sex. A few days later, Kenny goes to his roommate and says, I'm moving out. I'm moving to New Hampshire to live on this horse farm with my new girlfriend. And that was the beginning of the end for Kenny.
Kenny excitedly told his news to older brother Brian.
So Kenny says, oh, by the way, I have a girlfriend. So Brian says, you do? And he said, yeah, yep. He said, I met her on a Valentine's Day. We went out to eat before. He said, and she's rich. She has a big farm. She has a beautiful car. And she's 47 years old. So Brian looked and he said, what? He said, Kenny, no. You don't want to be with a 47-year-old. There's ulterior motives there. No, no. And Kenny looked and he said, no. He said, you know, she loves me. And I love her. And my son Brian said, you just met her. And so Kenny said, whatever you do, don't tell mommy. Don't tell mommy. And he said, you're my brother. Be my brother. Do not tell mommy because she'll come looking for me. So Brian never told me.
When at the farm, Sheila begins to isolate Kenny from his mother.
Sheila is doing the same pattern as she had for all the other men. Sheila begins by trying to cut Kenny off from his family.
So I think what you have here is a man with cognitive deficits, so he wasn't able or he didn't feel entitled to escape, and a woman who clearly is very capable when it comes to controlling men.
Carolyn, fearful for her son, calls him night and day.
I call the Epping police.
When Kenny is not returning mom's phone calls, that's a red flag. Kenny's mom has to find out, you know, what is going on? Is he okay? So she contacted the police in Epping, New Hampshire.
And so she'll call up the police and she'll say, listen, my son is staying with this woman and this woman is abusing him. You need to help him.
So the patrolmen go to Sheila's farm and they knock on the door and they say, we want to talk to Kenny.
Sheila didn't like that because of the fact that I sent the police to her house for a well-being check.
But when the police try and follow up on this and they go to speak to him, both Sheila and Kenneth actually say, I don't know what that woman's talking about. I don't know what my mother's talking about. I'm fine. I want to be here. I'm a grown man and I want to be here. So that's never actually acted upon.
Sheila had the run of Epping. What Sheila said went. She'd be able to say anything to the police. They didn't want to deal with her, so they just back down.
As with Deloge, LaBar tape records staged conversations with Kenny.
At one point, she had over 300 cassette tapes of things her on the telephone. Some of it's pretty innocuous. Some of it is, you know, rather disturbing.
She had tapes of Kenny accusing his mother of molesting him, and also, as with Michael Deloge, of Kenny confessing to being a pedophile. Nothing on tape was true.
She probably had a gun to his head, don't know. But she had him saying all these horrible things about me that I sexually molested him when he was a baby, that I continued to do that. It was just horrendous. And Kenny was telling Sheila all these things, and she was very, very graphic, and she was very nasty. And I was dumbfounded. She did all the talking. His voice became yes, no. And it was very robotic. When I heard that tape, I didn't want to see him anymore. I didn't want to talk to him because it was just so, it was horrible. It was horrible. But that's Sheila.
When Carolyn calls the police about her son, she discovers that Sheila has also played a recording of Kenny's voice to the police.
And what the officer heard was Sheila berating Kenny and getting him to confess that he was a child molester and that he had abused kids. And on the tape, the officer could hear Kenny becoming weaker. And at one point, he heard Kenny vomit. And then he thought he heard Kenny faint because Sheila was saying, "Get up. You can't fake fainting." So Sheila made this tape as a confession for some reason. It seemed to be a proactive move because she had something in mind for Kenny and she wanted to cover her tracks.
The police did not respond to the complaints made by Carolyn or those made with an accompanying tape by Sheila LaBar. Kenny was an adult, they said, and anyway, they'd seen it all before. Men came and went from the farm many times, they said.
She would take young men to her farm, and they'd work the farm, and then she'd call the police department to say that they left. Well, I found that pretty bizarre, and I said, well, how do you know they left? How do you know she didn't hurt them? She could have killed them. Did she kill them? And they started laughing, and he said, no, that's not Sheila's M.O. And I said, did you ever go there to check to make sure that they were okay? Detective Cody said, no, there was no reason. And I said, is she going to kill my son?
Carolyn County had become fearful for her son's life. It's worth reiterating in the story of Sheila LaBar that the Epping police were aware that men regularly appeared then disappeared from her life. As regards Kenny, there were soon signs that he was being abused. He was next seen in public when out shopping, and he looked awful.
Sheila took Kenny to Walmart and he was unable to walk through the aisles himself. She was pushing him in a wheelchair. His face was a weird color and he had bruises and cuts and burns. And the thing that she was buying were diesel fuel cans. And she made Kenny hold these fuel cans as she shopped. So there's Kenny, he's slumped down, he's not really responsive.
He was spotted by a police officer, photographed, asked, "Are you okay?"
They asked Kenny if he was all right, his head was hanging. He was drooling. And she told him to shut the F up. At that point, the police should have taken him. They didn't.
Despite the fact that he looked like he was in distress, there was nothing for the officers to do. He wasn't a minor. They couldn't take him into protective custody. All they could do was watch Sheila push him out the door.
They escorted her out of Walmart. They watched her take him to the car and lift him from the wheelchair into the car.
Why had she bought so much diesel fuel when spotted with Kenny at the local store? How much danger was Kenny County in whilst down on the farm with Sheila LaBarre? Carolyn County did not give up on her son Kenny as he failed to return her calls. In fact, she contacted the police in Epping repeatedly.
"I'm putting on a second missing persons report. I want you to go to the house."
The detectives, after being pushed, they go out to speak to Sheila, and they want to know about Kenneth. Where is he? When was the last time he was seen?
When they got there, Sheila was not home. So they walked around a little bit, and they found a burn barrel. There was a fire going inside, so they went over and took a look inside.
They don't like what they see.
And what they found in there was a human bone. And on the knob of the bone was some human flesh. So now they are very worried about what has happened to Kenneth County.
The officers make no arrest. There is not enough evidence.
You can't just turn around and right away arrest somebody for a fire. There has to be tests that are done. Are these possibly human bones?
Sheila returns home, and she's angry that the cops are there on the property, but she lets them come into the house and see that Kenny is not there.
Imagine what that says about her. Imagine what that says about her sense of being able to manipulate, to control perceptions, about her sense of intelligence, her sense of control over the situation, that she will actually, you know, invite people to investigate a case that could lead directly to her.
Investigators think they see what could be blood on the walls. They also find Kenny's shoes, and they find it kind of odd that he would leave without his shoes. But they have no warrant to be there. They can't take any evidence. They decide, we're going to come back and get to the bottom of this.
Detectives return 2 days later and go back to the scene. The sneakers they had seen in LaBarre's home had gone. When asked, Sheila confesses to burning them. They return to the fire. The bones, which appeared to be human, have largely disappeared. But some bone shards remain and are sent to a forensic team for analysis.
So now, analyzing and sending those bones off, looking at those pieces of evidence, that process is now taking place. And it's probably now at the point where the detectives are no longer treating this as a missing person case. Where is Kenneth? They're thinking to themselves, what happened to them?
Inside the house, police carry out a detailed forensic investigation. Using specialized blood detection devices, they are shocked by what they see. Though attempts have been made to clean surfaces, there is widespread evidence of human blood on furniture and on wood.
An indication that there was an extremely large amount of violence that took place inside that room. Nobody can question the physical evidence that was there at that scene. it was close enough and enough probable cause to now go and arrest Sheila.
They asked her point blank, where is Kenny? And she pointed to a plastic bag filled with soot and bones, and she said, he's in there.
Later, a detective would describe what he saw to Caroline County.
I just want you to know that we found a bone, and as he put it, it was too big for a rabbit. And that was my son. That was my son.
Sheila did a lot to obfuscate the evidence that she had. She took bits of bone and teeth and smashed the teeth so that they couldn't be used for identification. She had dismembered the body. She burned it. And because of the charring, they could tell that it had burned at different temperatures. She had been burning and churning the bones. During the search for Kenny and for other evidence on the farm, they flushed out the septic tank, and it was there that they found some new evidence, but it was the driver's license of Michael Deloge. And this let investigators think they may be looking for more than one body.
The wallet and ID of Michael Deloge, I'd wonder, first of all, where now is this person named Michael? Who is Michael?
Michael Deloge. Michael had simply vanished from Epping, last spotted at Sheila's home. Labar's story of life and deaths began to unravel. Sheila, not in custody, knows that she's getting closer and closer to being charged with murder, and she isn't going just to wait and let it happen. She flees the state.
She needs to go someplace else. But they just don't want to let her out of her sight, so state police have some detectives tail her. But Sheila's pretty savvy, and she's able to get away, and she has a plan on where she's going. She withdraws a lot of money. She starts going by an alias. She calls herself Casey, which is actually her middle name, and she decides that she's going to get her hair colored differently and that she's going to go on the run. She sneaks out of the hotel that she's staying in and wanders to the interstate and starts hitchhiking. And a man picks her up.
The man, called Steve, has no idea that he's taking a wanted woman out of the state.
So Steve picks her up in his car. And after having some breakfast together, they continue down to Boston. And she gets a hotel room with him. And the two of them have sex. And then he leaves. And it isn't until he sees the news that Sheila is a wanted woman that he realizes who he had picked up.
Before too long, Sheila moves on to another man to help her avoid detection.
While Sheila is hiding out in Boston with police all over New England looking for her, she's holed up with a guy by the name of Kenneth Washington. He just met her on the street, she came on to him, and she was able to crash at his place. And when Kenneth Washington sees Sheila's face on the TV news, he realizes who he has let into his home. And he calls the police and essentially sets up her capture.
In March 2006, Sheila Labar is finally arrested. 2 years later, her trial for murder begins, and the case turns on what's been going on inside the mind of Sheila Labar.
The defense's strategy was not to argue that Sheila wasn't the killer of Michael Deloge or Kenneth County. What they did was argue that Sheila was insane.
Sheila tells the story of what she did with Kenneth and Michael in the hopes that she's going to try to claim insanity.
Initially, she pleads guilty, and then she reneges and says, actually, no, guilty because I'm insane, for reason of insanity.
In order to claim insanity, you have to, at the time of the offense, be able to prove, and the burden is on the defense, in this case, Sheila, that they didn't know what they did was wrong. Why this story would unravel with Sheila is because of the amount of planning that went into her murders and the cover-up. Somebody who's crazy isn't going to try to burn evidence. Somebody who's crazy isn't going to try to cover up the amount of blood that was inside the house. Somebody who is crazy isn't going to methodically pick the most vulnerable of victims.
After several months of testimony, the jury eventually finds that Sheila was sane at the time of the killing.
Sheila LaBarr is found guilty of the murders of both Michael Deloge and Kenny County. She eventually confessed. But were there others? What about the men that came and went on the farm that nobody saw ever again? Certainly, other gruesome evidence was discovered.
This is 100 acres of pasture and forest, and this ended up being the biggest police search in state history. They patrolled as much of it as they could, looking for any evidence of a crime, maybe bones that are the remains that had been scattered someplace. You know, they couldn't find anything except a pair of human toes. You know, one of the things later about the human toes was that they didn't belong to Kenny, and they didn't belong to Michael Deloge. So, who is it?
It's worth underlining. Human bones found on the farm were not those of the two men that Sheila LaBarr had been convicted of killing.
We don't know how many victims are truly out there that may have come across the past of Sheila.
On this farmhouse, turns out that Sheila killed twice, possibly three times.
We don't know how many victims that are out there that Sheila actually was able to suck into her web.
We know that Michael Deloge was killed. We know that Kenneth County was killed. But what about some of those other guys that were spotted going to the farm but were never seen leaving it? It's hard to say.
So somewhere out there, there's probably another missing person, somebody that was one of society's vulnerable people.
Sheila LaBarr had suffered an abusive childhood at the hands of men, including her father. She grew to become a woman who men found attractive. But her outward appearance did not speak to what was going on inside Sheila's mind. Her looks were simply a way of giving her control, forgetting what she wanted.
So she's good at manipulating people. So someone asks for a companion, she sends sexy photos. She's able to move in. She's able to kind of keep somebody under her control to the point that everything that he has is left to her. Then later on, she has someone else move in, someone whose mother is so concerned that she's calling the police, yet she's able to say to his mom, do you know what? He's under my control now.
LaBarr was given two life sentences. She will never be released. Wilfred LaBarr's life was never the same after he allowed Sheila into it. Michael Deloge's life was taken by her, Kenny County's too.
She looked at him as somebody that society wouldn't miss. She didn't count on that mother's love.
How she could have taken a human life and do what she did to him and laugh at it. He was somebody's child. He was my child.